Deutschlandfunk. Informationen am Morgen.
Catherine, essentially, you're telling the story of the post-Soviet KGB, KGB officers who quickly learned to change their behavior, and now they're commanding a vast empire of Russian state companies, having already transferred billions of dollars abroad, using this money to slowly undermine Western institution and democracies. In the center, there's one person. It's Vladimir Putin. Do you consider him the sort of mastermind of this decade-long agenda?
I'm not sure Putin himself personally is the mastermind. He's more of a frontman in a collective of former KGB men that he brought with him to power when he ascended to the presidency in 2000. And this is a clan of ex-KGB men who all kind of cut their teeth in Leningrad in the Soviet era. And because they're from Leningrad and because they're from Russia's second city and not from Moscow, in many ways, they're a lot more ruthless than those who hail from Moscow. And you can see that in the way that they've operated ever since they came to power, in the ways that they've challenged the West. We know that they were much more ruthless because when Putin was deputy mayor in St. Petersburg, he and his allies from the KGB also kind of worked very closely with organized crime to control the capital's cash flows. There's one ex-former KGB officer who worked with them closely then who said that he couldn't stand to do so, and he moved away very quickly from any partnership with them. But he said that because they're from Russia's second city, because of this, they have an inferiority complex and they have a chip on their shoulder, and it makes them act much more ruthlessly than perhaps others in the more refined Moscow KGB. And I think it's certainly the case that perhaps others, maybe Yevgeny Primakov, who was also once a candidate to take over as Russia's president, would never have challenged the West and torn up the rule book quite so as ruthlessly as Putin and his allies are. So there's this clan of ex-KGB men around him, they're all from Leningrad. One of the most senior ones is a guy called Nikolai Patrushev, who is the head of Russia's Security Council. And he's a few years older than Putin, and he's very hawkish on the West indeed. Indeed, he can be seen as the mastermind, really, of Russia's attempts to turn the tables on the West and use capitalism to undermine its democracies.
I found many parts in the book in which you address also the public in Europe and in the United States and Great Britain. Basically, you're saying be aware and know what these guys are doing. What are the techniques they're using?
Yeah, they're really kind of turning to a playbook that was first deployed in the Soviet era. I mean, it was a playbook that the West kind of very quickly forgot about after the end of the Soviet Union. The West believed that Russia was now going to be part of the Western rules-based order and that Russia was essentially a weak economic basket case, and all that remained for it to do was to integrate with the West. And it was from that sort of quite condescending and also a little bit arrogant point of view that most Western leaders approached Russia. But they forgot about this playbook of the Soviet era, when the KGB would use front companies and kind of intermediaries through kind of trading schemes and so on to pile up cash in a very intransparent manner and then funnel these funds to fund the operations of either allied communist parties in the West or to kind of engage in more illicit disruptive activities such as disinformation campaigns or even political assassinations or influence operations to try and install their own allies in power. And they do this through using the equivalent of today's offshore companies and funding them, funneling the money into these operations. And they were really quite skilled at doing that. But I think the West forgot about it, opened its arms to Russian capital following the collapse of the Soviet Union, and was indeed with the belief that the more Russia integrated with the West, the more it would have to behave and follow Western corporate governance models. But in fact, the opposite happened, because once you had Putin coming to power, he and his allies were able to take command of Russia's strategic cash flows and then divert much of it through webs of offshore companies. We've only seen the kind of the tip of the iceberg of what they can do through leaks such as the Panama Papers and so on, and then begin funneling it to their own allies in the West or into operations to try and disrupt and divide our democracies. And again, we're only really trying to get to grips at the moment with being able to follow the money, because they use so many intricate schemes.
What do you think? What's the ultimate goal of Vladimir Putin and the Siloviki?
I'm afraid the ultimate goal is not a very constructive one. Of course, they want to restore Russia's standing as a great power on the world stage. And they could do that through creating a competitive and strong economy. But they don't seem to have the skills or the know-how to be able to do that. But what they do know how to do is to take control of cash flows and then divert them into underground or black operations. And so, first of all, when they collected the kind of control over the strategic cash flows of the economy, they needed to do so to shore up their own power at home. They could use it for propaganda operations at home and to make sure that they won elections and all the regional elections went their way. But as soon as they kind of reached a certain critical mass, they were able to divert these cash flows to undermine and disrupt the West. And it's not, I think they don't have a policy in which they want to I think the only way they know how to become a great player on the world stage is to undermine their rivals. It's not a strategic or constructive position. It's a tactical one, and it involves disrupting and trying to undermine their main adversaries, their great rivals abroad. And we see that now. We see how that's happening too now in this Ukraine standoff, because they need disunity in the West in order to kind of strengthen their own position.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you could argue that could stop them, especially in this this Ukrainian-Russian crisis that we're seeing?
Yeah,
now.
I think there's a lot that could stop them, and the main thing is Western unity, and I guess we're not seeing it so well at the moment, in particular from the German position. And I was speaking with one former Russian banker quite recently, who's now based abroad. His bank was taken from him by the Russian state as part of this attempt to capture control of all cash flows. And he said really that the only way to really change the behavior now of the Russian leadership is to cut them off from the energy revenues. You can go around targeting oligarchs for all you're worth with sanctions. They'll just move money from one pocket to another. They'll give the funds to their relatives or create other frontmen in order to move the money around the globe. But the only way to really challenge the Putin regime, particularly now when energy prices are so high, is to find ways to cut off their access to energy income, because without that, the Putin regime can maintain its hold on power for many, many years to come. They'll have enough cash coming in to sort of continue not to grow the economy, but to at least make its social payments to kind of the budget workers and teachers and pensioners and so on. And that will be enough to maintain their grip on power. Mm-hmm. But if their challenge over these energy revenues, if their hold over these energy revenues is challenged, then that could really lead to a new era of perestroika, because indeed that's what happened in the 80s, which led to this regime change in the first place, in the great reforms.
It seems to me that one important tool in this scheme to collect all the revenues from the energy market is, of course, the state-run company Gazprom. among others. And you spoke about Germany's role in the political sphere. German companies, as well as European companies, have built Nord Stream 1 and 2, of course. We have our former Chancellor Gerhard Schröder, who has an important job not only at Gazprom, but also in a governing body of Rosneft. How important are these state companies? Let me put that another way. How do they work? How do they work in favor of Vladimir Putin's political goals?
Yeah, I think we've seen for a long time that really through Gazprom, the Kremlin has been able to extend a great deal of influence into the heart of Europe. I remember sort of back in 2007, 2008, talking to one senior Western banker who worked closely with the Kremlin, and he was saying, just look at all these Gazprom intermediaries, the trading units in Germany. They're all staffed with former Stasi officials. And these are ways that kind of cash can be funneled to officials and begin to sort of corrupt them or be used as a way of kind of implementing Russian soft power. I mean, we could only see that just this weekend in the statement of the, well, now former head of the German Navy, who said that Russia should just be recognized as a great power, it should be shown respect and everything will be well. And that seems a bit nonsensical when Russia is the one that has a buildup of 100,000 troops on Ukraine's border. And so, but you can see that this is a way of kind of trying to win influence through having such a strong economic presence. And it's something that's really kind of also an extension from the Soviet era. We knew very little really about Putin's role when he was a KGB officer in Dresden in East Germany. But you can see this very clear thread that has continued ever since then. When Putin was based in Dresden as a KGB officer, he was the main liaison officer with the Stasi. And we know from the German Bundestag's own investigations that when he held that position, there were operations underway to try and preserve Stasi influence networks. They knew that the East German regime wasn't going to hold, that there was going to have to be some change and that the regime could collapse. So in anticipation of that, the Stasi began funding the construction of hard disk plants in East Germany, one of which was very close to Dresden in Thuringia. They did so through funneling tens of millions of Deutschmarks to a guy they named as a Stasi agent, someone called Martin Schlaff. Mm-hmm. And he was the recipient of huge amounts of funds through front companies in Liechtenstein, Singapore, and elsewhere. But hey, what happened, according to the German Bundestag's investigation, was the hard disk plant never got built. None of the components ever arrived. But Martin Schlaff had funneled the money away through his front companies, which then created companies in Austria, which were also all staffed with former Stasi agents that he and Putin worked with in Dresden. And then he appears much, much later, after Putin came to power, running one of these Gazprom intermediaries. And one of these Gazprom intermediaries was also involved in early political influence operation, also in 2005. It was called Centrex. And the Austrian arm of this company is staffed by Schlaff and his former Stasi officers. And Centrex was involved in a deal in which there was a gas deal with Gazprom, and the gas was going to be sold at a very high rate into Italy, and the firm that was going to be capturing hundreds of millions of euros in profits happened to be part owned by a friend of Silvio Berlusconi, the Italian prime minister. So these are ways in which covert cash flows can be funneled into Western political systems. And I think Gazprom, through its intermediaries and through people like Gerhard Schroeder, the former chancellor, has been very, very effective at doing this. And I was just reading recently this wonderful piece in the Spiegel about how Manuela Schleswig has been operating perhaps on some of the with some of these same schemes, having set up a foundation to help promote and look after the climate, and it's funded with hundreds of millions of euros from Nord Stream 2, which, as we know, is another Gazprom funded operation.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting what you're saying. You published the English version of your book already in 2020. Mm-hmm. And of course, you could not have described what is going on now on the border of Ukraine and Russia. If you would publish it now or like in I don't know, 3 months, or would you include these recent developments in your book, and how does it fit to your basic idea, to your basic thesis?
Well, I think I would have to include it because obviously it's a major development, but I think it would have to go at the end. I wouldn't change the structure of the book in any way, but it's almost, it's kind of a culmination of everything that's happened and everything that I was trying to trace. It's the culmination of the Putin regime's efforts to gain recognition for Russia, to kind of restore its standing as a great power on the world stage. And as I said, not through anything constructive, but through trying to disrupt its neighbors and to undermine and create disunity in the West. But it's very disturbing tactic. And actually, to me, it's more also a sign of the Putin regime's own desperation now, because at the moment the book finishes with Putin's attempts to change the constitution, to prolong his time in power. And essentially, my conclusion about that was that Putin really was quite tired of being president, but he couldn't allow himself to stand down. And indeed, his inner circle, the people around him, also could not allow him to stand down, because they'd acquired and accumulated so much power along the way through such nefarious methods, whether it be apartment bombings in Moscow back in 2000 or these poisonings that we've seen along the way, that they've become sort of more desperate to hold on to power. But the longer they hold on to power, the more they run out of tricks to kind of bolster their own standing domestically. So it seems to me, you know, the economy's been stagnating for many years. In fact, people's incomes are now 10% lower than they were eight years ago. They're running out of road, really. So they're looking for a binding ideology. And the only binding ideology that they have to keep themselves in power is to kind of create a mythical standoff with the West. Of course, they'd like to recapture Ukraine. Of course, they want to recreate these spheres of influence in which the West respects and also does not dare to encroach on Russia's influence, and in which Russia can also now start commanding that NATO withdraw from Romania or Bulgaria. But it seems to me that, of course, they're not strong enough to do that, and they kind of know that. But what they will do is sort of try to spook and create this confrontation with the West they're trying to bully the West into making security concessions. But deep in the back of their minds, I think Putin also knows that the minute he sends troops into Ukraine, he is going to face his own domestic backlash, because it will lead to Russian soldiers being killed. So it's kind of it's like this crazy game of chicken that he has concocted, he and his inner circle have concocted, to try and restore Russia's clout. It wants the same standing as the Soviet Union wanted to have, and they think that they can do it, but it's almost a crazy, desperate scheme that they need to shore up their own power at home as well.
Mm-hmm. Is it that you're thinking that the system finds itself permanently on the brink of either prolonging its power for another year, another 2 years, another whatever, another some time, or collapsing very soon?
I don't, you know, I can't see it collapsing very soon, unless, of course, they do allow themselves to be trapped into some terrible war in Ukraine, because I think, you know, that could be the same as invading Afghanistan was for the Soviet Union, essentially. The people aren't going to be very happy when the body bags start piling up, and Ukraine will fight back, and it is beginning to get military assistance from some countries in the West, including the UK, and the US has just sent more funding. So I think it would be a tactic that would ultimately backfire. But I think Putin has really overestimated his own strength here. He has been banking on this disunity in the West. He's been banking on sort of being the West being overwhelmed with its own problems. We know that Biden faces a very divided and weakened society. We know, of course, about all of Boris Johnson's own corruption and political problems. And we know that there are large swathes of the German political establishment who have, to some degree, been captured by either Russian money directly or just by influence. And we only just heard from Emmanuel Macron, who said he wanted Europe to come to its own security arrangement with Russia. So these are all the buttons that Putin thinks he can press. But I think he expected that the West would fold more quickly, that he would get some kind of concession quicker than he has, because they're making all these demands. We want a written answer to our draft proposal to redraw the global security map. We want responses to NATO's withdrawal from Romania and Bulgaria and this return to the 1997 borders. They're almost kind of craving attention. But I think they thought they would get concessions faster. So we see this kind of continued bluster almost, and on hot air. Now they've announced these kind of huge naval exercises in the Pacific that will go on through February, which is a sign, really, if you're announcing these big naval exercises, that you perhaps don't intend to go to war in Ukraine, but you certainly want to make a great show of force. But this is really very, very dangerous tactics, because, of course, when you have military buildups like this, when you have multiple plots going on, you've created a tinderbox, and at any moment there can be a provocation or some tiny skirmish somewhere that can somehow escalate out of anyone's control. So it's really very, very dangerous and, as I said, desperate tactics indeed.
Mm-hmm. During the research for your book, you talked to a lot of people and you named them, most of them. Some, of course, stay anonymous. But there are prominent names, prominent figures also, like Yakunin or Pugachev and others. Mm-hmm. Why did those people from sort of the core of the system talk to you?
I had quite a good relationship with Yakunin, stemming from my work as the Moscow correspondent from the FT. And he liked to talk about things that weren't sort of immediately about Russian railways or kind of Russian state strategy. He liked to talk, for instance, about how it felt when he was returning from serving undercover as a KGB officer in New York, when he was returning to a collapsing empire in Leningrad. And he liked to talk about those early years in St. Petersburg. But he also liked to talk about how the Russian regime under Putin was now in a position to unite the Christian world and the world of conservative values against the degenerate and consumerist West. So it was just interesting to speak to him, to kind of gain insight into the viewpoint of some of the KGB men around Putin. And I think, you know, ultimately they're all people, and they like to share things. They like to explain their point of view. Pugachev, obviously, he was a very close insider. He was very close to Putin in the late 90s and for his first two terms in power until they kind of fell out rather spectacularly. So he knew a great deal, and we were able to build up some rapport of trust. And he sort of, the more we spoke, the more that he shared with me, and it became very clear that the stories he was telling were very consistent, and indeed some of them were backed up by further documentary materials. So, you know, it's also a kind of the great luxury of writing a book is that you don't have to write something the next day. Whatever somebody's telling you isn't going to appear in print immediately. So you can establish relationships with people. And sometimes they forget that you're ever going to write anything because you're talking to them for so long.
I think it was last year, right? Then when some oligarchs filed lawsuit against the publishing house HarperCollins, and it turned out they had to apologize for some inaccuracies. What went wrong?
Well, you know, there was one error. We had a series of lawsuits that were filed against the book at the end of March last year. And this was 2 months after Alexei Navalny, the jailed opposition leader, waved the book in the air and quoted from it in his video about Putin's palace. Watched by millions and millions of people. And I think this act brought it to the Kremlin's attention in a way that had never done so before, that they suddenly brought much greater scrutiny of the book. So, we can't say. We don't know whether that's true or not, but it's certainly the timeline might suggest that it may be true, because 2 months later, first Roman Abramovich announces he's filing suit against the book, and then he's swiftly followed by two other oligarchs, Mikhail Friedman, Pyotr Avin of Alpha Group, who are barely mentioned in the book at all, then by the state oil giant Rosneft, which tried to claim that we defamed it by saying it participated in the expropriation of Yukos, and then by another Russian billionaire too. And some of these oligarchs were making quite exaggerated claims, which hadn't been included in the book at all. For instance, and some of these claims were indeed thrown out by the UK High Court, in particular the Rosneft one, which the UK judge said was not defamatory of the company at all. So we're really being bombarded by legal claims. We did eventually settle all of them, and Rosneft withdrew its claim entirely by itself, because its three main claims were thrown out by the court. There was one error, so it's not inaccuracies plural. There was one error involving Abramovich's ownership of Sibneft. I'd written in the book that Berezovsky was an owner of Sibneft. This was a Russian oil major. This was something that was widely believed across Russia to be true, and I was sort of citing my own 20-year experience of reporting from Russia, including sort of former business partners who said, yes, he was an owner of Sibneft. Mm-hmm. However, you know, I'd overlooked the fact that the UK High Court in 2012 had found that Berezovsky was not an owner of Sibneft. And so basically, you know, we have apologized for making that error. And we also apologized for perhaps not making as clear as it should have been clear that a claim that Abramovich had been ordered to buy Chelsea on the orders of Vladimir Putin was not fact. We don't know 100% whether this is true or not, but that it's the view of three of his former associates. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we've amended the text slightly to make clearer that this is the view of his former associates, that they say Putin may have asked him to buy Chelsea Football Club. The book always recorded a denial. We believe that the way it was written had made clear that it wasn't, you know, we're not, it's not possible to verify whether this is true or not. We'd written whatever the truth of the matter, the purchase became a symbol of the Russian cash that was flooding into the UK. But now we've made that even clearer, and there's more space for Abramovich to explain his own motivations for the purchase. And so for that, you know, given that this was an incredibly intense legal campaign, indeed experienced media lawyers have said they've never seen a legal attack of such intensity and scale. You know, given that defending the book against these claims last year cost more than £1 million, and had we, even though we believe we had a strong case, apart from the one error about the Sibneft ownership, that we had a strong case on everything else, it would have cost millions more to defend in court. We were very, very happy to reach a settlement at the end of last year, in which all the main claims attacked in the book remain in the book, but again with some minor amendments which give Abramovich more space for comment, and in which we kind of modulate some of the language as well.
Thank you very much, indeed.
Thank you.